800-965-1290.
One of the components in Phase 1 of the U.S.-China trade deal includes tough intellectual property protections. The United States and China are both working to combat counterfeit or pirated goods, and many of those goods end up on Amazon and eBay. Peter Navarro is the director of the National Trade Council at the White House. He says companies like Amazon, eBay, and Walmart need to get their act together.
We have a huge problem with counterfeits coming into this country. I've been running an operation with Customs and Border Protection for the last 6 months that show that as much as 10% of the products coming in from China by air are contraband. Half of it's counterfeits. The other half are things like controlled substances, including fentanyl. It's stuff really that can harm or kill Americans and certainly defraud them. E-commerce is a big enabler of that. Amazon, Shopify, JD.com, Alibaba. I've been working on this. We came out with an action plan 10 days ago with the Department of Health. And we also came out with an executive order last week, which is going to essentially crack down on the e-commerce platforms and others if they will not take their responsibility and help solve this problem.
For more news, please remember you can find us online at usaradio.com or on Facebook at USA Radio. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on 100 in Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@100-chamber.org.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Well, hello, everybody. First Friday in February. Wow. I'm Pat Smith's program, It's the Law. Just wanted to give you an update on the weather. I live in an area where we have wells, and we just also received a call from the electric service and letting us know about the hazardous weather. They always give us a heads up if they expect possible problems with electricity. I know we've had enough problems with the telephone and the internet yesterday and today to last a long time. But that is a hazardous weather conditions. Tonight, until about 7 p.m., there's a wind advisory. And, you know, if you're in one of those areas where it really gusts, it is gusting out there. So what happens tonight then and this afternoon, of course, there was a chance of showers, and they called it breezy. Well, it was rain, depending where you were. We had some snow for a while, didn't stick on the ground, but North Hunterdon County did. And tonight they're decreasing clouds. Tomorrow should be a very nice day if its prediction is correct. It's 40 degrees and sunny. By tomorrow night, mostly cloudy. Then there's a slight chance of snow showers. And that's all we had this afternoon were snow showers, although it wasn't predicted. Then by Sunday, slight chance of rain or snow, then a slight chance of showers. Doesn't say that it's going to be nice and sunny on Sunday. So this will be the day to get outside or do something. This weekend is going to be Saturday. By Monday, late Monday, showers are likely, both Monday and Monday night. So what else is happening? Well, this is the first weekend without football for all of us football enthusiasts. So what else is going to be happening? Well, I just wanted to remind everyone, although it's only February 7th, next month is St. Patrick's Day, and there will be a parade in Clinton near the Red Mill, and that will start at 3 p.m., And then this year there's going to be an after party, and I've been guaranteed that it's going to be a hootenanny, well, whatever. And it's featuring the Amish Outlaws, rather strange on St. Patrick's Day, but they apparently are going to be honorary Irishmen for the day. This is the Irish, where they call themselves the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick's, Hunterdon County, New Jersey. I've had a running battle with them since it should be the Friendly Sons and Daughters of St. Patrick's. But in any event, it should be fun. There are going to be step dancers, a pipe band, the Amish Outlaws, and tickets are $40. And there are a couple people to contact, and they can be purchased at the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick's Hunterdon County Facebook page. And, of course, once again, ShopRite is going to provide the wines and spirits. I hope they get something for it, because it could be a lot of wine and spirits on a St. Patrick's Day party. Anyway, that's my announcement for something going on. There's also going to be another open house at the here at the Chamber, and we'll announce that more in the future. Hopefully, if you know anyone who's not a member of the Chamber, great, you know, it really is a great organization. Reaches out to everyone. And so what else is happening? Well, I was expecting guests today for the law program. I'm not sure what happened, but I was not able to contact them, and they didn't contact me. So let's talk about what's happening in the legal. There's some interesting, I think, interesting news with respect to the marijuana legislation and convictions in New Jersey. So I'll just play a couple spots. And come back. If my guests aren't here, we'll talk about that.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care. At a moment's notice, Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
Okay, we're back, and let's talk about expungement, marijuana legislation, convictions, etc. I'll spend a little time on this because it really is an important issue. And it's an important issue because there are all kinds of folks that have some kind of a conviction in their background, and the law is changing. It's an important thing because there can be people can expunge their records and get somewhat of a fresh start. So, obviously, the marijuana legislation, the pros and cons of it have been debated for decades, and I really mean decades. Incidentally, I'd like to give a shout out to John Hogan and Michael Schraff for an article that they wrote with respect to this issue, and I'm taking a lot of my comments from their article. And believe it or not, there are the larger firms here in New Jersey. Not only do they have criminal law divisions, but they also have cannabis law, and sometimes they call it cannabis law, health law, and corporate teams. But this, there are a lot of the larger firms that are setting up at least an area of their practice, and there are attorneys out there setting up an area of their practice to deal strictly with this type of past offenses. And it's not just the criminal attorneys out there. So if you're someone or know someone who had some kind of a conviction, they really should look into the fact that they might be able to deal with that conviction and wipe it out. So, as I said, recently there's been an expansion of New Jersey's medicinal marijuana program, and there's also been a rollout of legal hemp cultivation and a referendum on recreational use for those who are 21 and older. And that's planned for later this year. So in any event, all of these issues point to the significant and sustained efforts by lawmakers to address the impact of marijuana convictions, and through that would be done through the reforms to the expungement laws. So that's what's so important. If someone has a marijuana conviction on their in their record, they should in fact take a look at whether or not it can be expunged, because these things stay on a record for a long time. So even though New Jersey is and has always been considered tough on crime, the New Jersey lawmakers also recognize that rehabilitation and reintegration into the community should be, or I think they'll say must be, the ultimate goal of a successful system of criminal justice. Unfortunately, the United States has more people, especially men, imprisoned, and the percentage of people imprisoned in this country is really rather astonishing, or people who have a criminal offense on their record. And compared to other countries, our laws are not only are they strict if you get convicted, but the punishment is pretty, it's really incredible, especially that three strikes and outlaw, and even people with very low-level offenses were serving a lot of time. So, in any event, what happens? Well, with regard to the low-level offenses, that is really the goal. Let people get rid of their records if they were convicted or pled guilty to low-level offenses. So the on December 16th, just a little more than, well, not quite 2 months ago, the New Jersey legislature passed a bill, and which the governor signed a couple days later, and it is enacted as PL 2019 C-269. Now, this amended the expungement statute for marijuana and hashish offenses, as well as other criminal offenses that, you know, I'm not going to talk about today. So the law becomes fully effective on June 15th, 2020. So that's a date for people to keep in mind. So what does it mean? Well, what is expungement? Well, expungement is the legal sealing of a criminal record from public view. And frankly, it's generally considered the most effective means to afford a path forward for those who have fully served their punishment, but whose public arrest records limits employment opportunities and other societal benefits. It's especially the employment opportunities, because felons are very limited in the types of jobs that they can get. And some of these, what we would consider pretty low-level offenses, were in fact felonies in New Jersey. Now, the interesting thing that is going to come up in the future is, the fact that things are expunged from the record. Does it make a difference if all of this stuff went out on the media and on social networks? For example, not dealing with this, but in another area, I had a client who was indicted, and it was spread all over the news. It turned out that they actually did not proceed, did not go forward. So there was nothing done in court other than the prosecutor dropped the case. However, it's anybody who looks up this person's name is going to find all of this information about the arrest, about the indictment. Of course, they won't find anything about a conviction because there was no conviction. Nor will they find out that the prosecutor's office dropped the case. So that is going to be also the problem if, in fact, there was any publicity about these drug arrests. So someone, although they won't have the felony conviction, or they, I should say they will have a felony conviction, but it could be expunged, the record be expunged, but there's still, you can't just assume that everything is going to be, no one's ever going to find it out. So what expungement does is, as I said, it doesn't erase news articles, social media posts, and any other publications. However, it officially seals the official court and law enforcement records of whatever happened. So at least that would allow the person who obtained the expungement to avoid disclosure of the expungement record. And additionally, of course, it's not going to help if you have a very unusual name and, you know, that name is plastered all over social media or news articles. However, it may help people with, it will not help people with unusual names, because if you have a very unusual name, people are going to know it's you. If you have a common name, you know, the John Smiths of the world, you know, there are how many John Smiths? So they would probably easily, be able to not worry about such social media if they were just outed with their name. So John Smith, I once represented a woman whose last name was Smith. First name was fairly common. I can remember because we transferred some real estate, and there must have been 50 pages of judgments against the same name, and we had to go through each one of them to confirm that she was not any one of the same name Smiths that were listed as under the judgment search. So, getting back to this, additionally, expungement arrests or charges will generally result in no record. When there's a background check, and it will also effectively restore an individual's reputation and be a step towards rehabilitation if they need it. I mean, there are a lot of people out there, middle-aged, who have some kind of drug arrest and drug conviction, etc., on their record. These friends of mine have given another example. For example, the person arrested for once smoking marijuana as a college freshman would encounter significant hurdles in achieving professional licensure in a number of professions. That includes a teacher, lawyer, pharmacist, nurse, architect, engineer. Kind of reminds me of the arrests back in the 60s against Vietnam. Although I have to say that some employers were, you know, happy to see someone who protested the Vietnam War. But I'm not laughing about this. This is very serious. So that there could be these kinds of real significant hurdles. And certainly I know more about the legal profession, and I will say that at the very least, bar examiners, no, it's not the bar examiners. The bar examiners are the people that the test is a bar exam. But there's a it's character and fitness, I recall now. And if there's anything on someone's record, obviously they have to disclose it. And the character and fitness committee will scrutinize it. And they really do scrutinize it. Certainly, I think a marijuana conviction for smoking a marijuana cigarette is not at the same level and would not be considered the same as some kind of a fraud conviction. That would be, you know, really probably an absolute bar to getting a law license, and should be. I mean, one of the concerns is, as attorneys, we handle a lot of money for other people, and we have to be sure that every member of the bar is scrupulously honest. So I mean that. So anyway, expunging a record prior to applying for licensure. So anybody who wants a professional license, if they could expunge their record prior to applying for licensure, would allow the person to respond no in nearly all questions regarding that situation, and would also remove the impediment to a chosen career path. So lots of concerns out there when someone has a criminal conviction. So there's also a legislative trend of reducing the waiting period for expungement eligibility for low-level offenses. So this new law introduces sweeping changes to the existing expungement eligibility filing process. So the eligibility filing process has lengthy waiting periods and precise requirements. Now, for example, this the Senate bill, which passed by the New Jersey legislature, that was number S-4154, expands the eligibility for the expungement of marijuana and hashish offenses. And it streamlines the following processes. For example, the filing process, and it imposes no limits on the number of marijuana and hashish offenses that are eligible for expungement. That's really significant. In other words, apparently, and we'll see how this works out, but apparently somebody with 10 offenses could still be eligible for expungement. But as most people say, most significantly, by September 2020, these offenses are to be automatically expunged through a rollout of what is called the Clean Slate Expungement System. And this system, although you never can count on anything, but it's expected to automatically expunge dismissed charges without the existing requirement to petition the court. And incredibly, a clean slate expungement will automatically expunge an entire criminal history after 10 years, assuming, that is, all offenses are otherwise subject to expungement. So this, if the other offenses can be expunged, then it will be automatic, notwithstanding limits on the number of offenses on the criminal history. So huge, huge change. So currently expungements are not automatically granted, and the eligibility depends upon the exact nature of the conviction or disposition. So upon eligibility, a petition must be filed with the court, and eligibility depends upon factors that include whether pending charges or other convictions exist. So are there some pending charges now? Are there other convictions? And then whether other convictions are contained within the same judgment of conviction or closely related in time and circumstances. So then also when the sentence was completed or fine paid in full, whether the person has satisfactorily graduated from drug court. So these are all things of significance. So generally a dismissal case, I should say a dismiss case, can be expunged immediately, and that's either through the traditional expungement process or if requested in court at the time of the disposition. So, but we also know that obtaining the order for expungement can take months, and even once it's issued, it can typically apparently take between 4 and 6 months for the official record to be ended. And when I should say not ended but sealed. The official record is sealed, meaning that except so in some exceptional circumstances, no one can see them. So apparently, the criminal record search will reveal the existence of the arrest, charge, and disposition until the State Bureau of Identification complies with the expungement order. So they realize it's going to be some kind of a difficulty doing this, getting it done properly. So in order to address the difficulty in expunging distribution convictions, this amendment takes the unusual step of reclassifying distribution and possession with intent to distribute up to a certain weight. So it changes that. It addresses that difficulty because if someone either has, you know, distribution charges or, more significant, the possession with intent to distribute. So in the future, these are going to be, we don't call them crimes, but they will be crimes that are not, well, how do I want to say that? They are crimes that will no longer be crimes. They'll be considered disorderly persons offenses. And the reclassification will permit the expungement of multiple unrelated crimes. And that's what is very significant. I mean, if somebody really turned his or her life around, you know, they can have some pretty horrendous things on their record, which will go away for all practical purposes, will go away. So, talking about going away, and I'll be back to just follow up on this, but wanted to bring you a couple more spots and from our sponsors. And as I said, I think we'll talk about this and maybe a few other things. Certainly, I hope people take advantage of it, and I'm sure that the attorneys who work for maybe it's going to be the public defender's office, people who qualify for free legal services are going to or should be out there in droves.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Hi, back again. I'm Pat Smith's program, It's the Law. Been talking today about expungement for low-level marijuana and hashish offenses. And frankly, anyone who had any kind of an offense, felony, should take a look at the possibility of getting the records expunged, because this is a big game changer, and the it demonstrates New Jersey's commitment to contribute to the full rehabilitation of those limited by the stigma of their cannabis criminal histories. Interesting, now they call it cannabis, other than all of the other names we used to use for it. But in any event, you know, when you read and look at some of this, I mean it. It seems as if some of these offenses were, you know, worse than triple murder. But the fact is, if you have a felony offense, you have a felony offense, whether it's triple murder or, you know, smoking a joint and having a couple extra joints and being charged with not only possession of marijuana, but intent to distribute. And that's what it was done. That's always the way it was done. So now the consequences of disclosure in connection with housing, employment, voting, and other fundamental aspects of sustaining yourself in society are going to be a lot easier. So, but also, probably more importantly, the amendments will further distinguish cannabis offenses from the more insidious substances that we find ourselves trying to deal with, and that's, of course, opioids. And once everything is fully implemented, the amendments will provide meaningful relief for countless individuals, and it's a long time coming. And I'm not sure why anyone would say that someone after a period of years should not be able to expunge their offenses. I can understand to some extent whether there will be some concerns about, you know, expanding this and allowing it to be used for all those other offenses, because they did have individual. They did have, it's important that we do as much of this as we can, while still, of course, protecting the public. But there are guys and gals out there who really turn their lives around, and yet they walk under this dark cloud forever. Of course, the other thing, believe me, that, I guess a lot of us could say there, but for the grace of God go I. I certainly saw that in federal prison for women in Alderson, West Virginia, where you found so many women incarcerated for really low-level drug offenses, and some of them incarcerated for fairly lengthy sentences. And, of course, most of them had been involved with a man in their life who, you know, there weren't many women gang leaders back in the day, or even now. So what else am I going to talk about? Well, I think I'll completely switch to talk a little bit about some of the family law opinions from 2019 that I don't want to say the top 10, but that's, in fact, what some people would say. So I'm just not going to comment on, well, maybe I will comment. One of the issues that comes up constantly is from men who are paying alimony is, when can I stop paying? I've been paying for, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 30 years. So there was a case where this was unreported. It was, in fact, an appellate case. But the issue was, if the payer's ex-spouse has good cause to retire and his income is now lower, and, in fact, it was reduced and shown. So that the question is, can a court deny the man's application to terminate alimony because he now has significant post-divorce savings and at the same time his ex-wife dissipated her assets and has debt? Well, you wouldn't think that this poor guy was going to get punished for saving and his ex-wife get rewarded for, you know, spending all her money, spending extra money, being in debt. So that's one thing I want you to, consider. So the fact is that based on the totality of the circumstances, there would be, in this case, there were minimal consequences to the ex-husband if alimony continued, but apparently a great hardship to the ex-wife if alimony stopped. And so what happened in this case, the court weighed all the factors under the statute. And for those of you who like statutes, the statute here was 2A:34-23, (i), (3), and (n). So this woman gets to collect her alimony. And it was a 23-year marriage. However, at age 75, her ex-husband was forced to close his business and he retired. She was 65. His income was $46,000 a year. And he had $4 million in post-divorce savings. So, and by the way, the ex-wife was earning about $70,000 a year. But apparently, either her excuse or what happened is that she said she was not able to save money because she was supporting her daughter and grandchildren. So that was situation where most of us would look at it and say, wait a minute, why wouldn't he be able to stop paying alimony after all these years? But that was the reasoning of the court. So there was, this has been a huge, huge and the next one, as I said, was Cassavetes. Okay, and the defendant there was Martinez. So the trial court in this case suspended or talked about suspending driver's license. So let's go on to see what happens there. And the issue in this case, Cassavetes versus Martinez, this again was a law division case, and it is going to have significant impact, although it was unreported. So the and the unbelievable part of this, and we can all thank an attorney who recently passed away, David Perry Davis, for all of his work that he did in this matter. He was really a pioneer, and I think anyone who is ever in this situation where they could have a driver's license suspended should be, you know, think of him and be so grateful. In any event, the question is it a violation of due process to suspend a driver's license for non-support without providing adequate notices and opportunities to be heard? And the answer is yes. So the second question is whether an indigent person is entitled to representation, legal representation, if his or her license will be suspended for non-support. So this all goes to non-support. And the problem here was in New Jersey, you could be driving down the road thinking everything is hunky-dory, be pulled over and told either by the state police or a local policeman that you have no driver's license in New Jersey, no court order indicating that you're paid support in full, a report, in fact, that you owe child support, and two or three other things, which are very important, but not necessarily for this. So what happened here then is finally Judge Mary Jacobson, this was a Mercer County case, delivered a 187-page written decision, but it took her over 500 days to write it. So that was the real concern. And guess what? I have my 4 o'clock, who is supposed to be here with guests today, John Manfreda, has just walked in. So let's talk about something other than the...
Is the mic on?
Yes.
Oh, good afternoon, Pat. And hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to be here. And Pat, yeah, I was supposed to be here with a full program, but that, unfortunately, my guest canceled, but I can still present a good piece of it. If you give me an idea of what you've been talking about to this point, and I know you have a couple of ads to run as well.
Well, actually, I'm fine until the end of the program. What I was talking about today was the new legislation on expungement of marijuana and hashish convictions, which is really big for all of those people who had these, you know, low-level convictions years ago, and really has...
But they're still of record.
Well, not only are they of record, but it has really made it difficult, if not impossible, to get professional license. You know, for,
yes,
you know,
that is quite frequently an impediment.
You would never think of this, of course, since you had a sterling record.
I
but,
do.
Character and fitness folks did not like convictions for marijuana. So for those many people who ran into the problem of smoking a few joints when they're in college or high school, but usually college because you're over 18, and then had a few more and were convicted or ended up pleading guilty to possession to get a, maybe probation, that has haunted them for years. But in any event, let's get on to something other than that, since
just a quick note on that. It is very relevant, not just for professional licensing purposes, but also for credit purposes and other things where they pick up your past history. It's probably long overdue, given the changing of social mores, the society's view on these things. And I don't necessarily share that view, but again, this show is not about my personal views. We're reporting on what's happening, and I think more in line with what's the prevailing thought is around the country. We need to get in line, and as you say, these low-level convictions, certainly not for possession above a certain level or for distribution or even intent to distribute, I think those will be much more difficult cases to obtain expungement. So, but I'm glad you dealt with that, because that does affect a lot of people. What I was going to actually talk about today, Pat, was some financial impact on families and really post-matrimonial items that deal with financial planning, but my financial planning guest couldn't make it today. And Pat, as a family law attorney, immediately following the entry of judgment, the next big issue becomes, how do people survive? How do they make it economically? And there's a bunch of complex rules that attach to that solution, and not always viewed as fair, depending upon, whose foot the shoe is on, I guess. And you and I have shared many discussions like that. But assuming that there are some assets to equitably distribute, Pat, the importance of getting to a proper financial planning firm is it can't be emphasized enough. I'm sure you'd agree with me, and that you counsel your divorce clients on those issues.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that we run into all the time is, and it's usually mom who wants to stay in the house with the kids. And dad really says, he doesn't care, except he's on the mortgage and the mortgage note. In fact, sometimes he's the owner.
Well, when you say stay in the house, Pat, do you mean a situation where they both continue to own it?
No, they both.
Or he conveys over his interest?
He does not want, he convey, let's say it's a situation where he's conveying his interest to his wife. The problem is, he doesn't want to stay on the mortgage, with good reason.
Of course.
If he's still on the mortgage,
he's still responsible if she defaults.
Well, that's not even the concern many times.
It goes on his financial statement as a debt.
Well, and even that's not the concern. The real concern, because you can, first of all, you can personally figure that out. And if everybody agrees that mom and the kids should stay in the house, or dad should stay in the house, what you can do is you can draft the kind of provisions that protect both parties, except that the real problem is he's not going to, in probably 99% of the cases, be able to buy another house. As long as he's on that first mortgage, that is against him.
Yeah, again, that goes on his financial statement. The other institution that he applies for a mortgage to sees that. And that's why, typically, Pat, wouldn't part of the settlement be that the spouse, in your example, the wife who's going to retain ownership, agree within a certain period of time to refinance that mortgage and take him off the note? But either she can't do it, or she's willing to do it, but the bank is, she's unable to obtain the refinance.
Well, that is the problem, because, it's not a problem. I'm just going to be doing one now, because in this case, my client, the wife, is not going to have any problem refinancing. However, it is a problem often because especially in the last few years where, you know, there, I know that they didn't like some of the lending that went on a few years ago, but I will tell you, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, we could go out, no problem. The wife would always be able to refinance.
Yeah, now, more difficult. Now, much more scrutiny is applied.
Much more difficult. And then the other thing is that banks, let's assume that dad is paying a fair amount of alimony to mom, okay? They, most banks, I've seen as much as a year, they will not agree to a refinance and count alimony.
Which is ridiculous because that, number one, the wife is receiving it. Number two, it's a substantial family piece of the family income.
Exactly.
So if they meet the guidelines based on the quantum of the income, okay, if you pull the income, why, Pat, would the bank not count the alimony?
Because what they say is there's so many people that so many, let's say men, default on it. And so they want.
But is it any more likely that there be a default than somebody could lose a job?
I understand, but that's why I think that this is, you know, this is really, all I can tell you is it's created huge problems because they want to see that the wife receives alimony.
Even if they get a financial statement from the husband or some type of statement of his employment and could reasonably assure themselves that his employment is steady or his assets are steady enough to support the payments such that they're reasonably certain she's going to receive that income, they won't do that analysis?
All I can say is there are many banks that say you have to show that there's been 6 months, some of them even more, but at least 6 months of regular alimony payments, which, of course, you don't want. You want to do this at the same time. I actually had a case once where we were agreeing that the husband would directly pay the mortgage payments for 6 months. And this, so the bank should have been fine with it, but they said, wait a minute, it doesn't show that the wife paid them.
Because Oh my God!
So it you know the
underwriting can be very difficult.
It really can. So in any event, but everybody going through a divorce should have financial planners. They really should.
Well, what would you recommend, Pat? Would you recommend, for example, before a spouse files for divorce, should they consult with a financial planner at that point, or during the divorce, after they filed, and certainly post-judgment? What would be your recommendation?
I certainly, and I don't want to sound sexist here, but if it's a traditional marriage where the wife has not...
Or has the lower of the two incomes, or none.
No, in this case, I'm thinking the wife for the following reason. If she's not handled any of the finances...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And if she wants to keep the house, one of the real concerns is, can she afford to do it? In other words, there's a... You may know pretty much how much the alimony, how much the child support is going to be. What I find sometimes with wives is they're totally unrealistic with respect to whether or not they're going to have enough income to keep the house. And how much more income do they need?
And Pat, how do judges in the family division treat that, where let's say there's three kids and they're relatively young, let's say they're, you know, 8, 10, and 12, which means you have up to 10 more years before they graduate high school, and they can stay in the house, but the husband would make enough to pay alimony and to, you know, pay the mortgage, whatever, but wouldn't have enough money to do anything other than pay rent to an apartment, you know, for an apartment. Would they impose that kind of burden on the husband?
Well, ordinarily...
Seems almost punitive.
And in fact, up until the last change in the statute, I think it was, although most judges would recognize if this was still litigated. And the thing is, most cases by that time are not litigated. And very often, you know, a husband will say, fine, you know, as long as you can pay off the mortgage and I get credit somewhere else, If you want to stay in the house, you can.
Yeah, I mean, in a vacuum, I understand that. But for example, if the parties have gone their separate ways, and let's say one of the spouses intends to remarry, start a new family, and so forth, they need some place to live.
Of course.
And I would think maybe the other spouse, for various reasons, might not want to support that and say, well, you know, that's your problem. You want to run off and start another family and have a nice home. Well, you're just going to have to find the financial resources to support that. There's three kids here. They need a house.
Well,
and I would understand that.
But I think what I have found in general is that if the case is litigated, and most judges would say, look, if someone's a senior in high school, you're going to stay there so they can stay in school, maybe even a junior in high school. But if you have three little children, you have to look at the economics, and it might be nice, but depending on the size of the house, and that's the other thing. I mean, how much does somebody need? One person shouldn't be living in a
$600,000 house and the other person renting.
And
what you're saying is then they may compel a sale, yes, particularly if there's equity, allocate that to in some equitable manner so that perhaps both spouses can then go out and acquire a smaller house. Is that what you're saying?
I am. And the fact is, the statute now is written, is the idea, for example, with alimony is you're supposed to be able to keep and maintain the dependent spouse in the lifestyle during the marriage.
Which I've always thought is just so unrealistic.
Exactly. And the statute now says that both parties are entitled to that lifestyle if it can be maintained. And, you know, frankly, in probably 95% of the cases, it can't. I mean, the only time that it can be maintained is if, people are able to save. I mean,
if they have some resources that they're.
Recently, where these parties were saving $300,000 a year.
Wow, that's a nice case. Yeah. Those folks are going to be okay. But the average person, your average matrimonial family or client is not going to have that. So, well, we hope to continue this discussion next time. We will have our financial planning guest at Alliance Wealth Management in Flemington on with us in either later this month or early March. But we will have that full program, Pat. It'll be dovetailed with family law, with estate planning, and the other topics that we frequently address here.
Well, terrific. And then I'm going to end the program today. Couple commercials, we'll do the news, and we'll come back and do the sports guys.
Yes, we will, Pat.
Okay.
Thank you.
What do you want to do when you grow up? When we were young, it's a question we were often asked. As we get older, our passions become clearer, our pursuits become careers, and if we're diligent, we begin to plan for the life we want to live. That's why, at Ameriprise Financial, we ask what's most important to you. Starting with our confident retirement approach, your Ameriprise Financial Advisor will ask questions that help you arrive at a customized plan that allows you to realize your goals today, tomorrow, and throughout retirement. With the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Call Michelle Heide and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 16 Lee Street, Units 1B and 1C in Clinton, New Jersey. The confident retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump says Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney is staying on the job. Speaking at the White House, the president's rejecting a report that Mulvaney is on his way out.
That was a false report. I have a great relationship with Mick. I have a great relationship with Mark. And it's false.
Vice President Mike Pence is celebrating the jobs report and the U.S. economy as a whole.
This has been a great week for America and a great week for President Donald Trump. I mean, thanks to the president's leadership, we're in the middle of a booming American economy.
The vice president speaking there on CNBC, the jobs report shows employers added 225,000 jobs in January, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman was fired from his national security job at the White House. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Do you have an idea for an invention or new product? Do you think companies would be interested in your idea? Do you want to try to get a patent? Then call InventHelp now. InventHelp keeps your idea confidential and explains every step of the invention process. We create professional materials representing your idea and submit it to companies who are looking for new ideas. We have more than 9,000 companies who have agreed to review ideas in confidence. If a company shows interest in manufacturing your invention, we can negotiate on your behalf. We have helped over 10,000 clients receive patents. We also offer services including